What do you need for a good life? For a really good life, what do you need? Some would say you'd need prosperity, resources to do what you want to do, comfort, food and drink, the necessities of life, to be comfortable. Laughter, the best medicine that it is, laughter and jolliness. And many, I think today, would say above all, you need acceptance, to know that you're accepted and that you belong. Well, Jesus Christ is generally thought to have lived a good life. Many people who don't call themselves Christians would still say that Jesus is a great example of how to live well, and that if we listened to his teaching and followed his ways, we'd live better lives. But did you hear what Jesus said in that reading from Luke that we just heard? Blessed are you who are poor, who hunger, who weep when people hate you. Woe to you who are rich, who are well fed, who laugh, and when everyone speaks well of you. It's entirely upside down. Welcome to the Sermon on the Plain. Today, as we said, we're returning to Luke's Gospel, where Luke, the author, is showing us this certain person, Jesus, and we get to know him through the story of his life, which Luke's carefully investigated and has written down for us. And we've seen, as we've looked through it previously, we've seen Jesus' birth. We've seen a few moments from when he was very small. We've seen him arrive on the scene as the promised one of God. We've seen him win a battle as the new Adam, the start of the new humanity, a battle with the devil. We've seen him traveling around Galilee in the north of Israel, doing extraordinary things, showing his authority, and saying that he came to save sinners who know that they need him. We've seen him face opposition and call people to follow him. And he said to those who followed him that they would now fish for people. They'd call others in turn into Jesus' kingdom. These first followers were also appointed as eyewitnesses whose testimony Luke has used for his gospel. Well, today, having seen those things, today we come to the Sermon on the Plain, which begins on page 839. That's wrong. All right, it begins on page 837 of the Church Bibles, which is Luke chapter 6, beginning at verse 17. Have a look with me at verse 17. He went down with them and stood on a level place. A large crowd, a level place, that's why it's called the Sermon on the Plain, because he was standing on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem, and from the coastal regions around Tyre and Sidon. So here is described two groups of people. There's a large crowd of his disciples and his followers, including the 12 apostles he'd chosen as leaders and eyewitnesses, and a more general group, a great number of people, a general crowd who had come from near and far to hear him. And the second group weren't his followers, they were just people who were interested in him. They'd come, verse 18 says, to hear him, and to be healed of their diseases. And they were healed of their diseases and helped with some of the dark powers that afflicted them. But what Luke focuses on here, and he recounts at some length, is this sermon from Jesus which they hear. The Sermon on the Plain. It's the first extended piece of teaching from Jesus in Luke's Gospel. And as we read through and digest this sermon slowly over a number of weeks, which is what we're going to start doing today, we'll be hearing words that Jesus spoke especially to his disciples. Look at verse 20. Looking at his disciples, he said, and then he carries on. So primarily, he's speaking to people who follow him. But at the same time, sort of in the background of this, he's speaking also to others. This great group of people that we heard about. At the start of chapter 7, just over the page, which is the end of the Sermon on the Plain, immediately after he teaches, it says Jesus had spoken this to the people who were listening. That is, the same people who were described as the great number of people at the start of our passage. So he's speaking both primarily to his own followers, but in the background and listening in are all these people who are interested in him, but not yet his followers. As one commentator puts it, this sermon is not only instruction to those who are disciples, but invitation and challenge those who might become disciples. So that means whether you consider yourself a follower of Jesus this morning or not, or even if you're not sure, these words are for you. But let me be clear up front about one thing. This sermon will tell us a lot of things. By the end, we've gone through a number of weeks looking at it, will tell us a lot of things. But it won't tell us how to get into the kingdom of God, how to become a follower of Jesus, because it's primarily addressed to people who are already followers of Jesus, already in the kingdom. But it will tell us what life should look like for those who are in the kingdom, what values and traits people in the kingdom should have. So this isn't like a test you have to pass to get in, to get into the kingdom. It's more like a set of family expectations for those who are already in Jesus' family. And as we'll see, this set of expectations is very radical and very uncomfortable. It's very upside down to how we usually think. But as we'll also see, it is a wonderful kind of upside downness. In fact, Jesus' upside down ways are actually far more right side up than anything we could come up with ourselves. And even where Jesus starts with the Beatitudes that we heard today, they encapsulate this upside down, right side up thing. The Beatitudes are life upside down in a nutshell. And the word Beatitude is a word that's rooted in an old Latin term that means blessed. Because Jesus speaks here of who is blessed. And to be blessed, it almost means to be happy, but in the sense of being fortunate or favored. That's why this seems so upside down, these blessings and woes. Because who are the blessed ones, Jesus says? Verse 20, the poor. Verse 21, those who hunger, those who weep. I don't know if any of you have ever been really poor, not knowing how to make ends meet for the basics, you know, looking for coins on the side of the road so you can just afford the basics. I don't know whether many of you have ever been really hungry, not just hungry because lunch was a bit late today, but hungry because you haven't got enough food to be able to have as much as you need. Many of us don't know those things, some may, but many of us don't. Though most of us do know what it's like to weep bitterly over a great sorrow, to be one who weeps, perhaps over the loss of someone close. And these things don't seem blessed, do they? They don't feel blessed. What does Jesus mean then when he says that people in these states are blessed? Well, I think a good part of the answer comes in the very next words from verse 22. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For that is how the ancestors treated the prophets. Remember, Jesus is speaking here first of all to his disciples. And he speaks of those who are hated, excluded, rejected because of their connection to him. The Son of Man is Jesus' name for himself. And he says they can rejoice and be glad because their reward is great in heaven, because they're connected to him. So Jesus is speaking here of those who are physically poor, hungry, weeping, and he may especially have in mind those who are poor, hungry, and weeping because of their connection to Jesus, because of their faith in him has caused them to be those things, as well as those who are hated and excluded for Jesus' sake. And these poor, hungry, weeping, excluded ones who trust in him, it's them he calls blessed because of the reward that will be theirs, the kingdom that they've started to inherit, and the promise of being filled with food and laughter. Now, this is radical because it cuts through present experience to future hope. And it says, blessed are you because of that hope. And as we see the woes from verses 24 to 26, they reinforce that point very strongly, confrontingly strongly. They're like a dark mirror image of the blessings, like the yang to the blessings yin, if you'll forgive that. So, verse 24 to 26. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. Now notice, why are these people who seem to have all the good things, why does Jesus say they're in a woeful state? It's because, verse 24, they have received their comfort. Unlike the poor, the hungry, the weeping ones, those excluded, who can look to the future with hope, these rich have already got all the comfort that they're going to get. You might have heard of the marshmallow experiments, a set of studies done on young children where they were put in a room with a single marshmallow or cookie on a plate. And they were told that if they waited 15 minutes without eating it, they would get two. But if they ate it, they wouldn't get any more. And then they're left alone in the room for 15 minutes. Well, in a way, Jesus is saying that the rich here are like the kid that ate the marshmallow as soon as the adult left the room. They already have their comfort, and they won't get any more. They won't get any more. And let's be honest, this is very disconcerting. Riches, being well fed, laughing, indeed being well spoken of, these are things we like. They're things that we find good. But Jesus says, woe to you who are like that. And for those of us who are Christians, I know myself, we might be tempted to say, oh, he must be talking about non-Christians who are rich and well-fed and laughing and accepted, or bad people who are like that. But remember, just as with the blessings, Jesus is talking first and foremost to who? To his disciples. He doesn't change it. It's not that to this group he said this, to this group. No, blessed are you who are poor. Woe to you. This is uncomfortable. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. So, does Jesus think riches are bad? All who have them are doomed? Does he think being hated is the only way to hope? Well, not exactly. But there is a real radical warning here that we do need to hear. Jesus here reinforces a theme that comes up throughout Luke's gospel, and that is the great danger of certain things for our connection to God. The thing about being poor is often you can more easily focus on your need for God because it is right there in front of you. You know you can't do it on your own. You know you haven't got your own resources. You know you need the Lord. A danger with riches, conversely, is they can start to become more important to you than God, because they are the thing that you depend on, the thing you'd never give up. They are what you've worked for. They are where your security is, your freedom is. And that's, in that way, the poor are blessed with the hungry and weeping. Not because being poor and blessed and hungry and excluded is good in itself, but because people in that situation are driven to God. And well-fed, laughing, rich people, people like most of us, I have to say, because we don't think we're rich. Just consider, have you ever had the problem that there's too much food to fit in your fridge? Or that you need more than one freezer? Then we are rich, if we're even close to that. And the problem for us is, we can be in real woe. Because we can be strongly tempted to forget about God. We can find the sports and the holidays and the weekend activities and the house and the farm and the car, and the drum set, and the good food, and the self-fulfilled life, and the whatever it is, these things start shielding our eyes from our desperate need of a Saviour. And then the future reward, which from this gospel is clearly resurrection life, being raised like Jesus in the new creation, the full kingdom of God, that future reward and that hope can start to seem more like a pipe dream. Because we can feel like, well, we've already kind of got heaven on earth, haven't we? And one day, before we know it, our life will be suddenly over. And we will have let Jesus get choked out by everything else. I've seen it happen, I'm sorry to say. I can see the seeds of it myself. In myself. That's the danger of riches and of comfort. And of course, a similar thing can happen with being well spoken of, can't it? Being accepted by those around us, which matters so much to so many of us. And it doesn't matter, by the way, whether we're kind of in the more conservative end or the more liberal end or somewhere in the middle, because wherever we are, we still want to be accepted by someone, by the people who are like us. And it's even easier to fall into the trap of wanting to be accepted, because holding to a radical Jesus-centered view of life will get us out of step with the opinions of our friends, family, and our society and people we respect, no matter where we are on the spectrums of various kinds. If you follow Jesus and you take him really seriously and hold to a radical Jesus-centered view of life, it will get you out of step with people around you. And we will be tempted at that point just to let Jesus go into the background a little bit more. Just let him go backwards in our priorities, because he's a bit, we don't want to be too radical. We don't want to be too intense. We don't want to, you know, put people out. And before we know it, Jesus is squeezed out by our need to be acceptable. And we find ourselves quietly leaving him behind. Woe to us if that is us. But if we don't want that, what do we do? How do we take this upside down life seriously? What will it mean for us? Firstly, how do we live in light of Jesus' words? Well, there is so much in this, more than I can say today. It will repay careful, prayerful consideration. Can I encourage you this week to commit this to prayerful consideration, to let these words of Jesus here unsettle you? Maybe read them each day and ask the Lord to show you what needs to change. Here's a question to ask yourself as you consider these words. Does the fact that I'm a follower of Jesus really impact my life in these ways that he talks about here? Is there a real impact on my life in these areas? For instance, if because of our Christian faith, we are not poorer than we would otherwise be, then there's something wrong. If through our generosity to church or to others, if through keeping our word about what we'll do with our money, if not through the sacrificial decisions that we've made about the kind of job we do in order to be able to serve church better or to be disciple our children better or care for others better, if our bank account, in those kind of ways, if our bank account looks pretty much the same as it would if we weren't Christians, then there is something wrong. Following Jesus should have an impact on us in that way. And if we're not, in a way, more hungry than we would otherwise be, in the sense that we can't consume all we would like to, we do miss out on some satisfactions in life that we would otherwise get if we weren't Christians. If we don't sometimes say, well, I don't get to have that kind of holiday or that kind of car or that kind of hobby or that bigger house or eat out as much because I'm a Christian, because I've chosen to use my resources for God's kingdom, because I'm being obedient to Jesus' call not to be greedy, whatever it is, if we can't see where following Jesus makes a real change to us in that kind of way, there is something wrong. And if we're not, in a sense, more weeping than we would otherwise be, because we weep with those who weep, our persecuted brothers and sisters around the world whose sorrow we listen to and enter into because they are our brothers and sisters. If we don't share the pain of them and of others in our church because we're a church family, there's no more weeping and mourning in your life in those kind of ways because you're a Christian, then there is something wrong. And if we're not more hated, insulted, rejected because we belong to Jesus, then there's something wrong. If we never in our lives feel any pinch of mistreatment for Jesus' sake, there's something wrong. Now, I don't mean people don't like us because we bash someone with the Bible or we're rude or we're self-righteous or we judge and look down on others. We'll come to that in future weeks and Jesus will deal with us on that. Believe me, he's already dealing with me. But what I mean is being treated badly because you won't distance yourself from Jesus and his values. If we never feel the pinch of that, then there is something wrong. You see, following Jesus has an impact on your life. I need to say, you don't get into heaven. You don't get right with Jesus by doing these things. You get right with him by trusting him and putting your faith in him. That is the big message of the Bible. And so I want to make sure that's clear. But Jesus is here talking about how we should live as Christians, what it looks like to bear the family resemblance, how we honour the Lord by our lives. It should make a difference in these areas. And that is a challenge. I know. I have felt it this week. Lord, please help us to take your words to heart in our lives. But also, briefly, I said, how do we live? How do we help? See, Jesus clearly has a concern here for those who are poor, hungry, weeping, persecuted. So should we. And throughout the gospel, there's no question that Jesus' concern for people in those situations is very strong and that we're called to reflect it. And as we do, we need to both remember these real physical needs, which Jesus clearly highlights here, and yet we also need to not forget where the truest comfort of all comes from that future hope in Jesus. If we simply help those in need with our resources, our food and so on, at one level that's great, and yet we're shortchanging people at that point. We must, as followers of Jesus, be interested in more, not less. Not less. We must help with physical needs, but still more than just physical needs. We need to seek to share the truly great hope of a reward in heaven, which means sharing the message of Jesus as well as our resources. Jesus brings them together. In other words, we must reach out and care with physical resources, with food, money, clothing, water, company. But with that physical help needs to come us also seeking to share the message of Jesus, real hope of forgiveness and release from sin. One example of that is supporting aid agencies that seek to explicitly both care for the poor and share the message of Jesus. A Tear Fund is one that I know of that does this really well. I think Tear Fund does this much better than many other more popular aid agencies, which focus a little bit more strongly on the physical side, sort of almost exclusively sometimes. Tear Fund do this wonderful job working through the local churches of caring for physical needs in a powerful way. They do an extraordinary job of it, and yet always seeking to share the message of Jesus alongside it. I just wonder if you've considered sponsoring someone, a Tear Fund child, if you don't already. But there are more immediate ways to show that care as well, like getting to know those in need in our own community, caring physically and with the gospel message for them. And I know, this is a point I know, some of you have done that so well. You've actually inspired me in that. We need to keep growing in it. Jesus has a great concern for the poor, the hungry, the weeping, the hated. So should we. As we finish, I need to leave us with one thing. Because Jesus' words are powerfully challenging here. And if we're not careful, they will leave us, above all, with guilt. And that is not the point. These words are powerful and real. We must take them to heart. We need motivation to take them to heart, though. We need to remember that Jesus said them in the context of the life that he was living. He was living this upside-down life, and he was doing it for us. This reward in heaven that he speaks of, ultimately he won that reward for us. He was the one who made himself poor for you. He had all the riches of God, but he became a peasant and went to a shameful death for you, so that you might be eternally rich. He made himself hungry for you. He cried out on the cross, "I thirst," so that you might be eternally filled. He wept and mourned more than we will ever know as he bore the weight of our sin, so that all your weeping and mourning could be wiped away and you can have eternal laughter. He was despised and rejected and hated, dying a criminal's death in your place so that you can be accepted eternally, welcomed by the God of the universe, never to be rejected. And when we live upside down in the way he calls us to, we're only really echoing his upside down living. And we're doing it as an expression of trust in him, a display of thankfulness to him for the upside down life he lived, and the death he died for us. We're going to stand and we're going to sing in thanks.